So, hello, this is John Kramer with Open Horizons, author of 1001 Ways to Market Your Books, and creator of the New York Times bestseller campaign program, How to Create a New York Times Bestseller. This phone call, wait a minute, let me mute everybody. Okay, so I'm muting everybody right now. So it's just me on the line, so you don't get so much background noise. So I wanted to let you know about that. What I'm going to do is start by taking some questions because there are a number of people that still haven't joined us. So one of the first questions was... I didn't know how to operate this thing yet, and so what happened is I lost my first two questions. I can't read them right now. So the system has a few bugs in it yet. I'll have to report. But the one question is, what is the most important factor for a first-time author, nonfiction, to consider to become a New York Times best-selling author? And the most important factor is distribution. You have to have really good distribution if you're going to become a New York Times bestseller. Now, she's planning to, the person who asked the question, is planning to send the question, send her proposal to a big publisher, so she should have good distribution. Beyond that, the most important thing is coordinating a lot of publicity to hit in a very short period of time. Because the New York Times bestselling format is such that the best-selling numbers are measured from week to week, and so it's the rate of sale during 1 week that counts. How many books do you sell in 1 week? There are a lot of books that have sold more copies than many New York Times bestsellers, but never hit the list because they sold 50,000 copies a year, year after year, for many, many years, and ended up selling 1 million or 2 million copies, but never hit the list. A prime example of that would be Greg Godek's 1001 Ways to Be Romantic, which has sold more than 2 million copies, but never hit the New York Times bestseller list, not even on Valentine's Day. But, that's one thing that could be... So you have to really focus your publicity and your distribution to hit at one time in order to make it happen. Let's see, another question is, when is the next time that I'm going to be offering the full seminar that tells you all the inside secrets on how to do a New York Times bestseller campaign? The next one I'm doing is on May 8th, which is Tuesday, and but that will be recorded, and you can always sign up at any time and get all the recordings and all the documentation and have the full program. Also, because I've just joined this new teleseminar program, I will be offering some follow-up teleseminars free to the pioneers that sign up before May 8th. Those people will get in on a series of additional teleseminars where I'll be taking questions and answers on the problems or challenges that they're meeting in creating their New York Times bestseller. So I hope that answers that question. But you can sign up at any time. All the teleseminars are being recorded. And they'll be easy then for somebody to go and access the material. The one advantage of attending a real teleseminar is that you get to ask questions and get feedback. Okay, another question is, how important is it to have a publication date and why? And this is for a print-on-demand book. And the reality is, for a print-on-demand book, it doesn't matter if you have a publication date. It just doesn't matter. Print-on-demand is the poor boy's way of publishing books. It's not a bad way. It's a good way to test the market and so on. But publication date is most important when you're trying to create a real viable campaign to create a bestseller or to create some sort of momentum for a book. And with a print-on-demand book, you really don't have the chance to create a New York Times bestseller with a print-on-demand book. It just... that the numbers won't be there. They never will be with print-on-demand because you have to sell 2,000 to 10,000 copies during a week to become a New York Times bestseller. And with print-on-demand being printed one book at a time, that just never would happen. So that question's done. Let's see what the next question is. Wow, we keep getting questions coming in. I will get to the actual topic in a little bit. Another question, how many copies of a novel do you sell in 1 week to make the list? For a novel, it would have to be a hardcover novel, and you would have to sell probably about 10,000 copies in a week to make the list. For a nonfiction hardcover, it's easier to make the list. The competition isn't as strong. If it's a trade paperback novel, the chances of making the list is very, very small. And the reason for that is that the competition in trade paperback includes both fiction and nonfiction, and you need a lot more books sold in a week than you do with hardcover. So if you're a small publisher or an unknown author trying to hit the New York Times bestseller list, you're best doing it with a hardcover book. And there's just no way to get around that particular thing. Your challenge to do it otherwise is very, very high, because the numbers become more like 30 to 50,000 copies sold in a week. Maybe not that much. It depends, again, on the week. But it requires more sales than a hardcover does. Another question. This is from Iris in Tucson, Arizona. How does a small independent publisher arrange a campaign with a very limited budget in order to attract the attention of the New York Times? Boy, I go into detail on that in the full program. The basic way that you have to do it is you have to create a lot of publicity and at the same time get very good distribution. The details of how to do that, sorry, that's really in the proprietary teleseminar that I teach on Tuesday. To go into that would be unfair to the people who have paid for the full teleseminar and so on. But you do need to. With a limited budget, you can do it. And there are a number of ways to do it. One would be to do a lot of online promotion. The second way to do it, of course, is to get a lot of publicity. In my talk, what I do is basically apply in the bestseller campaign, the New York Times bestseller campaign, I take the principles of the Amazon bestseller strategy and I apply it. I put it on steroids, because you can't use the basic principles of Amazon and hope to get a New York Times bestseller without putting it on steroids. So what I do is teach you how to put it on steroids and how to implement that strategy so that you can actually create a New York Times bestseller, which is probably 20 to 30 times more difficult than an Amazon bestseller campaign. It may be much more than that, because you can hit the New York, Amazon bestseller campaign with as few as 300 copies sold. And for somebody who's doing a New York Times campaign, you have to sell at least 2,000 copies, if not 10,000 copies. And again, it depends on the week and a lot of other factors in terms of how many copies you have to sell to make that happen. A question from Michael in Temple, Texas. I have a book that was commercially published, sold about 3,500 copies, was dropped from the catalog after 3 to 4 years. I have it with a POD publisher and sell only a few copies here and there. It is still timely with plenty of life in it. The book is listed on Amazon and my own website. Can you recommend one surefire method for generating a few more sales along at a steady pace to put the book out there, earning its keep? For a POD publisher and a POD book, I would recommend that you put most of your focus of attention on selling books online. There's still a very, very strong resistance in bookstores to carry POD books, especially in any kind of quantity that would be worth your time to spend much time trying to promote through that venue. You're much better off doing a strong internet campaign, not just an Amazon campaign, but also creating relationships, doing a blog tour, things like that, that could create interest in your book and then would make it possible for people to buy your book online, either at Amazon or through your own website. Let's see, Catherine from Elliott, from Bellevue, Washington, she's question is, the pros and cons of self-publishing versus submitting to a traditional publisher and the impact that that can have on becoming a bestseller. There's no question that if you want to become a bestseller, your best strategy is to have a traditional publisher publish the book. Just absolutely no question about that. They have much better distribution than any self-publisher can get. And there's no way around that. But that doesn't mean that you can't self-publish a book and make it a bestseller. If you go to my self-publishing Hall of Fame, you'll find that there are dozens and dozens and dozens of people that have become New York Times bestsellers self-publishing books. But it requires a lot of good, savvy business sense to make that happen, because you really have to set up your publishing company, as a business, and then go about doing the things that you need to do to create a strong campaign to sell your book and get the distribution into the bookstores. It's very tough to hit the New York Times bestseller list without really strong distribution in the bookstores. In my full teleseminar for this campaign, I tell you what you need to do to get that kind of distribution and what you can do to support that distribution to make it effective. Let's see. Next question. This is from Darian. He doesn't say where. Well, maybe Hawaii. What about books that are released by a major New York publisher in the last 4 months? Is it too late? No, it's not too late. It's still possible to do a New York Times bestseller campaign at this point. As long as your publisher hasn't given up on the book and, you know, taken all the books out of the bookstore, as long as the books are still in the bookstores, you can do a campaign at any time because it doesn't necessarily require that you do, that you get a lot of book reviews or things like that. It requires more working on the Amazon bestseller strategy promotional campaign and making that effective. Okay, next question. This is from Tom in Australia. What do you do if your book is not available in the States? Well, first of all, you do not get your book on the New York Times bestseller list. It's just not possible. But what you can do is either get distribution in the States or find a publisher who has good distribution in the States that will publish your book. That is the only way you'll get a good, you know, a New York Times bestseller from a book published in Australia. That doesn't mean that you can't create a best-selling book in Australia. That is quite possible to do, having published in Australia. But if you want to create a New York Times bestseller, you have to have your book with good distribution in the United States. That means either, one, you sell the rights to a publisher, or you find a publisher or distributor with good distribution who will take your book and make it available in the U.S. But again, you're looking at having to sell 2,000 to 10,000 copies, and that means that you would have to have that many books in distribution, you know, right away in order to, you know, you have to have that distribution in place, those books in the bookstore stream, in order for it to happen in that 1 week. And so that's would make more sense if you're in Australia, rather than shipping 2,000 to 10,000 books to the U.S. and getting a distributor. It would make more sense to sell the rights to a U.S. publisher and then let them handle the distribution. And you can still do the entire promotional campaign while in Australia, because most of the promotional campaign strategy that I'm using is internet involved and supplemented by other strategies such as publicity and so on, but that they don't require that. Okay, a couple of people have just said hi. They didn't ask a question, and that's fine. Thanks, Mike and Phyllis. Let me see who else is asking questions here. Well, why don't I, instead of taking more questions right now, let me take and do some of the reasons why you want to become a New York Times best-selling author. One of the key reasons for doing that is that the prestige value of a New York Times bestseller versus an Amazon bestseller is just magnitudes of difference. When you become a New York Times bestseller, there's nobody that complains about you being a best-selling author. They don't question you being a best-selling author. There's no credibility gap. They don't grouse about you manipulating the list or anything like that, even though the list can be manipulated. Most people don't see it that way, whereas they do see it happening with the Amazon list. And there are people that resent it. They think that an Amazon bestseller is a trick, and it's not worth the value of being an Amazon bestseller. Plus, there are a lot of people who are calling themselves Amazon bestsellers when they hit the top 100 or even the top 1,000. And to me, there's a credibility gap there. And the New York Times list is very clear. You either hit the list or you don't, and there's no question. If you were number 16 on the list, you're not on the list. And you can't call yourself a New York Times bestseller until you do get on that list. So it's a whole different credibility gap there. The second thing is that a New York Times bestseller author has many, many more doors open to it as an author, as a speaker, as a consultant, as a trainer, and as a leader than any Amazon bestseller can possibly have. The respect and of a New York Times bestselling author, once you become a New York Times bestselling author, you can be your best-selling author for the rest of your life. As an Amazon bestseller, you can do the same thing if you want, but again, the credibility gap is just so huge compared to that of a New York Times bestseller. There are a number of other reasons why you want to become a New York Times bestseller author. One reason is because once you're on the New York Times list, what's one of the first things that happens? Every bookstore in the country puts your book in the front of the store where everybody can see it, face out, ready for people to buy. So you get prime placement in the front of every bookstore in the country. And that's not something that, in many cases, you can't even buy that placement. You have to go, and the only way you can do it is to earn it by being a New York Times bestseller. Another reason why you want to become a New York Times best-selling author is because once your book hits the list, what's the next thing that the bookstores do? They discount New York Times bestsellers by anywhere from 20 to 50% at no cost to you. They're still buying the book from you at the same price. 90% of the bookstores in the U.S. discount at least some of the New York Times bestseller list, if not all of it. What happens when your book is discounted in stores? More people buy it. It's more affordable. It's cheaper. You get the same amount of money as if they bought it at full price. But people are buying it at a lower price. That's greater value to them. It's more likely that they're going to buy your book because it's cheaper. Besides, of course, the front of store placement. The fifth reason why you want to become a New York Times best-selling author is very simple. You sell more books. It takes selling 2,000 to 10,000 books during 1 week to even get there in the first place, whereas with an Amazon campaign, you can make it with 300 copies or, in some cases, less, depending on how you define an Amazon bestseller. So if you create and carry out a New York Times bestseller campaign effectively, one of the first things that happens is that you sell a ton more books than you do through an Amazon campaign. Again, to make that To make that happen, you have to put the Amazon campaign on steroids. You really do. You can't just do a Mickey Mouse campaign. You really have to do it, plan it effectively so that you can sell that many copies. And it's obviously a much bigger challenge. That's why most people have settled for doing Amazon bestseller campaigns, because it's a little bit easier. It doesn't take as much time, and it doesn't take nearly as much effort. To do a New York Times bestseller campaign, I'm going to tell you straight out, it takes time, it takes discipline, it takes doing the work, it takes doing all the steps and doing them effectively. You can't hire somebody else to do it. I don't think you can. I don't think it's even smart to hire somebody else to do an Amazon campaign for you. I think it's much better for you to do your own campaign, because one of the main values of creating any kind of bestseller campaign is the relationships you create in doing that campaign and carrying it out. And that's something that you can't hire somebody else to do. And to me, that's the most important value of doing any kind of bestseller campaign using an Amazon strategy, is the actual relationships that you create in doing the campaign. The relationships you create with bloggers, e-zines, websites, the top thinkers in your area that you're having help promote your campaign. So let me go back to a few of the questions that people have submitted. This is from Cam in Denver. Is it possible to turn the volume on this webinar? Oh, boy. No, I don't know of a way to turn the volume up. I'm sorry. Boy, I don't know what to do about that. Gosh, I hope most of you are hearing me okay, because I don't know what to do with that. But again, that's something that I will mention to the people that run this service and see if there's a way to increase the volume. Okay, thanks. Okay, Deborah in Hot Springs. Who's your favorite print-on-demand for full-color coffee table-style books? I don't know if I have a favorite. I know there are a few that do it, but the one that I've seen do really nice work is Adibooks, Adibooks. I've actually seen their books, and I like what they do. And they're a good customer service-oriented company. So it's adibooks.com. Their other division, King Printing, are the people that printed my 1001 Ways to Market Your Books, 6th edition. So I guess I'm a little bit biased there because I liked what they did with my book, and I really like their service. Tom Campbell there is a really good man, and he really goes to bat for you as an author. Okay, Russell from Marietta, Georgia. He just wants to say hi and said thanks for doing the teleseminar. Okay, that was easy. That question I can answer very quickly. Gosh, questions keep coming in. Let me see now. This is Darren from Hawaii. What are the best weeks to attempt to make the list? That's very easy. The best weeks to attempt to make the New York Times bestseller list are the months of January and August. July isn't too bad either. And the reason for that is because you're not competing with the big New York publishers who are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to create bestsellers in the other months of the year. So that answer is very simple. Probably the least competitive month is August. That's because all the publishers are waiting to launch their books in September and October for the holiday buying season. January is usually quiet also because of the post-Christmas. Most people aren't buying as many books, and so the publishers aren't doing as much to try to promote during that time. Okay, this is Russell again from Marietta, Georgia. Why should I care whether my book about insurance claims becomes a New York Times bestseller? You probably shouldn't care. The chances of a book about insurance claims becoming a New York Times bestseller is pretty small. You'd be much better off doing an Amazon campaign for a book with a more limited audience, or simply doing the best you can in terms of marketing your book in all the ways that you want to market your book, and target market your book to specific websites, specific media, and so on. It's very possible for you to sell 100 to 200 or 300,000 copies of a book on insurance claims, especially if it's aimed at consumers, if you do your marketing campaign effectively. And this is true. I would never do a New York Times bestseller campaign for 1001 Ways to Market Your Books. The audience is too limited. I would do it for some other books that I'm planning to write, but I wouldn't do it for that book. Because the chances of me hitting the New York Times list on that, no matter how good a promotion I do, is really slim because the size of the audience is too small, the potential audience. you want an audience that's big enough, potentially big enough. For example, people who read novels, that's a big audience. There are people that buy, you know, a million novels a week maybe, or more than that. So, I mean, that's a big audience. The number of people who buy books on marketing books is a much smaller audience. This is Russell again in Georgia. How do I determine the price of a 200-page softcover book about insurance claims, showing consumers how to take control of their claims and collect hundreds or even thousands more dollars in their claim settlements? I've chosen a price of $29.95, but could the book be priced higher and still sell well? A book like that, if you can show with testimonials and so on that you're actually, you know, allowing people to make hundreds or even thousands of dollars with their claim settlements, people are going to pay more. But you're going to have really strong testimonials to make that sell with a good, strong guarantee as well. If you were going to sell at higher than $29.95, you'll never be in the bookstores. In fact, even with the 200-page book, because it's such a special interest book, you can probably charge $29.95 for it. But you couldn't go higher than that in a bookstore. No bookstore would carry it. And even then, your book isn't going to be in that many bookstores. You're going to sell a lot more online. What I would do, if I were doing your book, is I would have a $29.95 book as a print book and as an e-book for download. But I would also sell a higher price thing that would go for something like $97.95 or something like that. That would include different forms that people might need to use, perhaps even a step-by-step video on how to fill out the forms most effectively, or something like that, or some sort of software, little program, or even a few audio CDs that would take them step-by-step through a form to tell them how to fill it out most effectively. I know that you may do that already in your book, but I think that's what you would have to do. And you can see how this same strategy would work for anybody's book. So even though I'm answering Russell's question, it would apply for anybody with a very special interest audience where you could maybe even charge a higher price for something that has added value. I like to keep a lower price book to keep people, you know, to sort of bring people into a funnel. But eventually, you want a higher price product with extra value that you can sell that will help to justify the expense of doing all the different things that you might do on an internet campaign or even on an offline campaign doing PR and so on. And that might even justify doing a direct mail campaign. Let's see, a question from Darren in Hawaii. Should I learn the Amazon strategy before the New York Times strategy, especially since my novel is trade paperback and it's published by Penguin? Yes, you can learn the Amazon campaign first, strategy first, and, you can either learn it through my New York Times campaign where I'm going to really talk about, you know, the really detailed nitty-gritty of how to do an effective Amazon strategy on steroids versus, you know, what's out there now. So you can go learn from somebody else. You can read the section in my book that talks about the step-by-step how to do an Amazon strategy, or you can take my New York Times teleseminar and go from there. Because your novel is a trade paperback, your chances of being on a New York Times bestseller is much smaller. It's strengthened by the fact that you're published by a big New York publisher that might make it possible for you to carry it off. There are trade paperback novels that do become bestsellers, but usually that's because they've created good word of mouth that gets people into the bookstores to buy their book. And again, I talk more about that strategy as well in my teleseminar, because I think that even though the main strategy we're using is similar to the Amazon strategy, I want you to integrate the campaign with everything else you're doing to increase your chances of becoming a New York Times bestseller. Okay, Mike from Kansas City wants to know ways to increase online sales and more web hits in addition to trading links and online newsletters. The key thing there that you want to do is you want to get create relationships with the top websites, and that means more than just trading links. You want to contribute content to the top websites for your key audience and the keywords that you think people might look for your book. So that means that you really want to look, go do a Google and Yahoo search for your key search terms. Let's say old movie houses. I think, Mike, that's your subject. So you might look under old movie houses, or you probably have some other good terms already that you know that people, how people find your book. You want to find the websites that have those key search terms, or the top 30 websites, and what you want to do is contribute content to them. I talk about it in terms of creating a relationship, but the way you create a relationship is by offering them some sort of good content. Good content could be a review copy of your book where they can review your book. A second thing that good content might be would be offering to do an interview with them, where they send you a list of questions and you answer those questions, and then they post that as a text interview on their website. That's an incredibly good way to get content onto a website with lots of visitors. The interview is probably the best thing you can do in terms of giving content to another website. And there you just have to convince them that you're going to give extra value to the people that come to their website. And you can let them ask whatever questions they want, and then you answer them. A variation of that is to do a teleseminar with that website where they interview you live on a teleseminar or a webinar such as this, and then they put that teleseminar as a free download on their website. Now, that way people can even pick up more of your excitement, because live, hopefully, you come across as more excited than you do in print. If not, then emphasize the text. But if you come across well live, then doing a teleseminar with that website, if they do teleseminars, just tell them you'd be happy to do one with them. And here's what they could talk about that would be of interest to their listeners. A fourth way that you can do add content to a website is to offer them an excerpt or more than one excerpt from your book, and give them a chapter or two chapters or some section of a chapter, and allow them to post it to their website. Again, with all of these content contributions, there should be a link back to your website. But now it's not just a passive link saying, here's a nice website, go visit it. It's actually got good content tied to that link. This will increase the value of the link in terms of Google's eyes and Yahoo's eyes, because it's a much more valid link than just a passive, here, go see this website. But also, you've showcased your talent, your content, etc., so that people are much more likely to click on the link. A sixth thing that you can do is to offer them original content, an original article. A seventh thing that you can do is to offer to write a column for them on a regular basis. Once a month, you write another column. You could also have it be a Q&A column where their readers send you questions, and then once a month or once a week, you answer those questions. Now, that's incredibly great content for a website, any website. As a website owner myself, I love that kind of content. And if somebody offered me that for one of my websites, I would go, yay, God, you are a blessing in disguise, and I love you for it, and I'll be happy to forward questions to you or whatever if you contribute content to my website. Because what are you doing whenever you offer any kind of content to my website? You're making giving people more reasons to come to my website, where I can sell whatever I have to sell on my website. And if my website's a completely hobby website, well, then I'm going to love you just as much, because you're giving my hobby chances are I'm going to be interested in what you're writing about, because it's, if it's a hobby website, it's just all passion for me. I'm not making money, so I'm just going to be happy to pay attention to what you're writing, and so thankful to you that you're giving me that content. Now, the next question doesn't say who it's from, and it looks like it might be a long question. My book currently has major distribution, BN, Borders, Amazon, through my publisher, in an email campaign that I'm planning to do with about 5,000 in the database. How do I get everyone to buy during the same day or week? Well, for something like that, you do something very similar to what I would recommend you do is something very similar to what Bob Allen did for his first book back when he, after laying off for a long time, he wrote a book called Multiple Streams of Income, and we worked together to create a strategy for that book. And what he did, you know, the book was going to be published by John Wiley, so he knew he had good distribution. And he had his own e-zine list of about 30,000 readers that would hang on hang on his word. So what he did is he sent them an email and he told them if they buy two copies of his book from a bookstore during a particular week, one copy for them and one to give to a friend, he would send them a free report worth $100. Now, most of his e-zine readers probably considered that $100 report worth more than the books and probably wanted that more than the book. But he hit the New York Times bestseller list that week. And what he did is he had people had to fax him a receipt or email it as a copied document or something like that. And they had to buy two books. And that way he got them to do that. Now, there's an interesting variation that Seth Godin is doing right now. He's touring. He's going to like seven cities around the U.S., and what he did in his blog, he said, if you want me to come and do a talk in your city, what you have to do is organize a venue where 500 people can come. I think it was 500, maybe it's 200. And they had to pay, I think, $50 to attend or buy five copies of his current book. Now, the thing is, even if they paid $50 to attend, they were going to get five copies of his book. So basically what they were doing was buying five copies of his book, one for themselves and four to give away to friends. Now, this is a superb way to create word of mouth. But the neat thing for Seth, is that he didn't have to do anything. He put it out into his blog, and seven people stood up and said, I will organize it in my city. I want you to come. I want to meet you. I want to hear you speak. And I will get the venue, and I will get the people there. And so he's got like a seven cities that he's going to, and the people are, you know, and they're charging $50 per person. So if it's, I think it might be 200 people, but that's $10,000. That's more, 200 people done. Yeah, $10,000 of income being generated per city. Now, the venue might have cost him $1,000, and he's probably paying for the room. But he didn't have to pay for the promotion or anything because he has so many fans already built up into his list. This is an incredible opportunity. And the neat thing is that, he's giving them, a real reason to pass on, to buy more books. So if he does this right, he's selling essentially 1,000 books per city. So he's going to sell 7,000 copies in that 1 week through those venues. Now, they're not going to be counted on the New York Times list. But still, he's got 7,000 people, who will have a copy of his book in their hands in that week. And chances are they're going to read his book because his books are short, sweet reads. They're easy to read. And they're going to tell other people about his book. So suddenly he's got this whole campaign with a 7,000 person army out there promoting his book. So somebody said that I'm not going to offer an Amazon.com bestseller campaign. Somebody asked that. I'm only offering the New York Times bestseller campaign. I will probably write a book on how to do an Amazon bestseller campaign that will be more detailed than what's in my 1001 Ways right now. But the basic steps are already there in my 1001 Ways to Market Your Books. Excuse me. They also said that the problem with volume is probably not a web problem. It's probably a PC problem. And that I don't know. The person that indicated that she had a trouble listening seemed to have said that she turned her volume all the way up. There's two volume controls. There's usually a volume control on your speakers, and there's usually also a volume control, a software volume control in your computer. And if one or both of them are down, then you're going to have a volume problem. So maybe that will help somebody that's having that problem. Let's see. Next question. What are the best forms of publicity to get consumers to purchase the book during the targeted one-week period? Oprah. What a dumb question. What answer did you think I was going to give you? No, it's not a dumb question, really. The thing is that what you want to get, the best form of publicity is any kind of really mass media, any media that's going to have a major impact on your audience. If you've got a flippant sort of humor book, then you might want to get on Howard Stern's show. Or if you've got a political book, you want to get on Comedy Central, either on Stephen Colbert's program or on the other one, which I'm going blank on the name of right now. I'm having a senior moment. So anyway, that's you're looking for whatever the major media is that people pay attention to that are the potential audience for your book. Obviously, if you can get a major excerpt in something like Cosmo or Time or Newsweek, that's going to be gold. If you get a major review in the New York Times or USA Today, I mean, there's a lot of different things. But it usually has to be highly targeted and aimed at somebody that's going to really, some media that's going to make a difference, that has a big enough audience, or a collection of media that has a big enough audience. It's very tough to create a New York Times bestseller doing radio interviews alone, unless the radio interview is with somebody like Howard Stern, or back in the old days, Don Imus, before he disintegrated. Okay, so that's that question. Okay, let's see the next question. What do you think about forgoing all the bestseller hype and focusing on special markets? Well, that's very simple. I love special markets. I love focus. I love doing targeted marketing. I mean, that's how I built my business through all these years, because my 1001 Ways to Market Your Books is very targeted. I think there's very good reasons to do bestsellers, and someday along the line, I might do an Amazon bestseller campaign for 1001 Ways to Market Your Books, just to go through the whole process myself rather than just guide other people through the process, which is what I've done in the past. So I think that might be fun to do. It hasn't been a priority for me because my book sells very well anyway, and it's usually somewhere in the top 5,000 to top 10,000 on Amazon in any week, and has been for over 10 years. There's only probably 10 books maybe during that 10-year period that could make the same claim. Dan Pointer's Self-Publishing Manual is one of them. I'm not sure what the other books would be, but I know it can't be too many. And I would be surprised if it's more than 10 or 20 books, because there's so much in and out going on with all the other books that are out there in the marketplace, with 150,000 new books coming out every year, with all the different Amazon campaigns going on, with all the new Harry Potter books, et cetera, et cetera. it would be really interesting to find out, if I could find out from Amazon somehow, how many other books have been in the top 10,000 over a 10-year period. One thing is, I know that any books published in the last 9 years don't qualify. You know, so I know already I've eliminated a huge potential, competitors in terms of making that claim. But there are very few books that over a 10-year period could claim that they were in the top 10,000 during that whole time, or almost during that whole time. Let's see now. The bottom line for book marketing is sales, and that's the most important thing. And that can mean that you could be focusing on premium sales, group sales of different kinds, or doing a lot of target market selling, or going out and speaking and selling in the back of the room. Again, none of those things count towards the New York Times list, but they certainly count towards your bottom line and what the income you have and the reputation that you're building as a potential expert and as a speaker and so on. So you don't have to be a New York Times bestseller. The reasons to do it are because it does add to your prestige, but you have to have the right kind of book to qualify in the first place. Plus, you do sell a lot of books if you hit the New York Times list. One of the neat things about hitting the New York Times list is that once you hit the list, you're in the front of every store, you're being discounted. I find it hard to believe that a book can hit the New York Times list and bounce off the next week. You know, to me, if that author or publisher is smart, they continue to do promotion because already they're getting all this bookstore promotion. Why is their book falling off of the list when it's being discounted by 40% and it's being put in the front of the store? To me, the challenge would be to knock somebody off of that list when they have that advantage over me. But I do see a lot of one-hit wonders, you know, one-week wonders. So if somebody hits the New York Times bestseller list and next week they're off. And they shot their wad, whatever it was, and they stopped promoting. And even though they have that, you know, front-of-store placement and discounts, they still were not able to do, to carry that and make it live for longer. Now, that's sad, you know, in a sense. Okay, now let's see. The question goes on. My book is a trade fiction novel, which you said would be hard to get on the New York Times list. My husband Darren's book is a nonfiction hardcover about mental golf, psychology of the game. It hit number 17 for BookScan, but sales have been quiet now. What do you think? I think his book can still be a New York Times bestseller. It's a perfect book, Mental Golf, Psychology of the Game. It should have hit the New York Times list. When it was at number 17 at BookScan, if you did not communicate that information to the New York Times and to other key media, you missed out on an opportunity to boost that book up to a higher level. Because media love those kind of stories, and if you're paying attention and letting them know what's happening, then it can make a real difference. Now, BookScan measures, for those people who don't know that are on the call, BookScan actually measures the actual sales of books through computer. You know, the people that the stores that belong to BookScan, it measures the actual sales through the cash register. So there's no manipulation going on, nothing like that. Now, you could be number 17 on BookScan and be, you know, off the radar for the New York Times because of the way New York Times compiles their list. You still want to, you have to be aware that there's a manipulation going on with the New York Times list by New York Times, not by, you know, plus, of course, there's a manipulation going on by publishers trying to get on the New York Times list. I'll talk more about that in my New York Times seminar. This is Russell again with the insurance claims book. He said he priced it at $29.95 and the ebook at $19.95 and the audiobook at $23.95. Personally, I think they should all be priced the same. I know that people say that an ebook should be cheaper, but to me it should be the same price or even higher. People have instant access. I would never discount my book as an ebook. All you're saving is a dollar. I mean, why should there be a difference in the price? The people that want to buy my e-books should be willing to pay the same price, because to me it's the content that matters. And Russell, I would change your e-book price to $29.95 right away. I don't think you should undersell it. And if the audiobook is a full reproduction of your book, it should be priced at $29.95. If it's an excerpt, if it's a two-tape excerpt of your book, then $23.95 is fine. And whether or not you offer a discount, you say that you offer a discount on the audiobook of 40% when people buy one of the other books, that's fine. I think that's a great thing. But I would actually, instead of just offering a discount, I'd offer a package price for all three. And I would look for ways to add additional content so that I could get a $97 book or package that I could sell to people. So, and he said he expected most of his sales to happen on his website and through bulk sales to groups. And I think he's right that those are the great potential markets for the book. And I'm really opposed to people discounting their book, their e-book versus their book. I know there's a lot of people that recommend it and so on, but I'm opposed to it. I think you've now realize that I'm opposed to it. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to unmute you so those of you who are on the telephone line can ask questions in person and we can have a little bit more interaction. It's a little bit weird giving a teleseminar when I don't get the feedback, because it's sort of like speaking in a room of empty chairs. You know, there's just not the same reality as when you're speaking in a room with 100 or 200 or 500 people in the room and you're getting the feedback from them. So I'm going to unmute right now. And then you... So now it's unmuted. And so now we can ask some live questions.
John, can I ask a question?
Yes.
It's Sufit calling from Canada.
Okay.
Hi. I joined the call a little late, so I'm not sure if you answered this or not, but I'm going to be self-publishing a business book for entrepreneurs on how to get noticed in the marketplace. And the question is whether it should be hardcover or soft, because I seem to notice that most business books come out in hardcover first, but when I surveyed buyers, they said they wanted soft. And secondly, how I should price that.
If you're actually thinking of aiming for a New York Times bestseller, it should be hardcover.
Okay.
Because the competition for a hardcover bestseller list is a lot less than for a trade paperback. If you don't care about the New York Times bestseller list, then that part doesn't matter. Then I would probably do it as a trade paperback, but I would price it for whatever value I really saw it being worth. Now, the reason I would probably keep it as a trade paperback is if you're getting that kind of feedback from potential buyers, are these bookstore buyers or consumers?
Well, they're entrepreneurs at business entrepreneurial events.
Okay. And they want to trade paper because they want cheaper price?
They say it's easier to carry. I don't know. I like hardcover, but...
I would... If that's the only feedback, it's easier to carry, I would ignore it.
Yeah. Because hardcover doesn't have to be that much more expensive than
no,
paperback.
No, in fact, to me, a hardcover is easier to carry because it doesn't flop around. It stays protected better than trade paperback and things like that. There is also a perceived value that's a little bit higher with a hardcover, so you can charge a little bit more. Of course, it costs more to print, too.
Well, you know, in Canada, our prices are kind of wacky, but I had spoken to a distributor who said that it should be something like $16.95, which I thought sounded low for a hardcover 286-page book.
It's very low for a hardcover,
yeah.
even in Canadian dollars.
In U.S. dollars, but...
$16.95 U.S. dollars, that's way too low for a hardcover.
Hardcover
business book should be $23.95 or higher.
Somebody told
That's
me there's resistance
opinion.
At $20. I don't know if you found that to be true. Like your book is double the norm. Yeah, but yours book is double the normal size and has, you know, incredible.
I would feel very comfortable selling a book for $23.95 that was 200 pages hardcover business book. I would feel absolutely comfortable doing that, and I don't think you would have a drop-off in sales if the book is worth it and you get good word of mouth.
Would it affect bookstore sales, do you think?
No, I don't really think so. I've seen a lot of business books priced at $23.95 up to $29.95 or higher, and I don't see them not selling.
Okay,
now, of course, if you want to sell a lot of copies because you just want to sell a lot of copies because you're building a speaking career or something like that, then you might want to price it at the Who Moves My Cheese level, which I don't know what that price was.
That was like $29.95.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was crazy.
And it was
a tiny little book. Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know it was that cheap.
Yeah.
But there are books, for example, some of Seth Godin books are hardcover, or Jeffrey Gitomer books that are hardcover, but they sell for, I don't know, $19.95, $23.95. But I think those are well worth it, and I think he has met no resistance on his price.
The New York Times bestseller was.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's not a good idea to listen to everybody. There's a lot of people that have opinions, but they're not always good opinions. And the worst people
to
listen
to
The worst people to listen to are bookstores.
Really?
Because they always want you to price your book lower.
Mm-hmm.
If they could get you to sell it for $5, they would do that. Now, that's stupid because they don't make much money on a $5 book. But for some reason, they feel that there's a consumer resistance. And obviously, you know, probably one of the major feedbacks they get from people in the bookstores is that why are books priced so high? But the reality is, in consumer mind, is that books as a value proposition are worth much more than CDs, DVDs, videos, audios, et cetera, et cetera. Books are perceived as being worth more. And I also wouldn't listen to a distributor too much. I would take their opinion into consideration, but I would price the book at what to me is the right price for the book.
Okay,
distributors, because let me just finish. Distributors, because they're influenced by booksellers, tend to want to push the price down too.
Yeah.
And so you got to be very careful about listening to them because of that weakness that they have in terms of wanting to push that price down, when the reality is that the consumer is willing to spend what you price it at, as long as you're competitive with other books in the same area.
Okay, that's great advice. Thank you. And just one last question about PubDate.
Sure.
For a book for entrepreneurs, I was planning on April 1st, and it had been suggested to me January, which I really am not anxious to do. Do you think April 1st for a book for entrepreneurs is reasonable, or is January really good?
I actually think any time is a good time for books for entrepreneurs. You have less competition in January.
Less in January than in April?
You have a lot less competition in January than April.
Mm.
Probably as much as 50% less competition in terms of introducing new books.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because I had been planning to do April, but okay, well, that's good to know.
But the key thing is you have to publish on your timetable. That's far more important. If you try to rush it for January and you don't do all the steps and you don't do it well, then it's not going to help you.
When you say competition, are you talking about the ultimate consumer book buyer, or that the stores won't buy it as much?
No, when I'm talking about competition, the number of new books being introduced that month.
Oh. Okay.
There's much less media competition, much less bookstore attention competition, et cetera, et cetera, because there are fewer books being introduced in January than in April.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Somebody's playing this in the background.
Hi, John. That
yes.
was me. Let me turn that down. This is Darren. I'm calling from Hawaii. Thanks for answering all our questions. Appreciate that.
Sure.
My book is the golf book that came out on April 1st.
Okay.
And it did hit 17, and we're looked on BookScan, but that was for all sports titles, not all general titles.
Okay.
But what we're looking to do is do one last push before the books are, you know, pulled from the shelves for a Father's Day push, Father's Day. That's in about a month or 5 weeks, and I'm a person with a database and so forth. So
for that,
is it too tight to do something like that?
Oh, no, it's not too tight at all. it would be too tight to do much in terms of publicity, other than some of the weekly magazines or newspapers. Or, you know, in terms of magazines, it's tough to do monthly magazines. In terms of doing internet promotion, it's not too tight at all. If you wanted to do an Amazon campaign, it's certainly doable right now in the time you have, if you want to.
Right, right.
And it's certainly possible to, you know, to do a campaign sort of like what Robert Allen did to a limited list, even if you didn't have time to do a full Amazon campaign.
To get them to buy two copies on during a one-week period, say the week before Father's Day or something like
that. Now, you know, obviously, the more people that goes out to, the greater chance it is that you're going to have something happen. But you have to offer them something of perceived value that makes them want to do that. And what you could offer, if you wanted to, is a chance for the people to join in a teleseminar with you that you price at $100, let's say. And for 3 hours, you'll take all their questions about golf.
Right.
And if they buy two books, they get to join in. If they don't, they don't get to join in.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so that could be a nice incentive for them to sign
up. Yeah, I mean, especially if, you know, if they saw that as being valuable.
Right.
even better, of course, would be offering them, you know, a free flight to Hawaii to come and visit you and play golf. But, you know, for $2, that's not worth it, you know.
Well, we do have certain items.
But I tell you, I'd buy two of your books for that, you know.
You'd be the first one in line, right? Okay.
Yes.
Well, I do have a golf.
But you know, wait a minute. You know, I joked about that. But you could offer that as a prize.
Mm.
One person or two people or three people who submit, you know, the receipt for two books or three books or four books, will get that as a prize. Now, the risk you run is that if you don't sell enough books, you're going to be eating some cost.
Right.
But
right.
The neat thing is that if that part isn't, you know, if you sell 1,000 books, then it might be worth it. Or you could simply offer them, you know, they pay the price to Hawaii, but you take them to your local golf course and you play a foursome with them. So three people get to come and play with you in Hawaii and get to stay at your home or something like that if you have a nice home.
Right.
You know, something like that might be very attractive. And
well,
I
have a golf academy, so I could have people come out. They could do it at a golf academy.
Well, yeah, and that would be great, you know. And for that, you know, even then I might sign up, except that I'm not a golfer. I've only played golf once, and I hit 110. But that was for 9 holes. You know, so, you know, I was hacking away. Actually, I played golf twice. So I'm not a golfer, so, you know, that wouldn't be that incentive for me. But I do think that you have a book. You know, golfers love books about golf. And to have an opportunity to play with somebody who has a golf academy, that's what you have, right?
Yep.
In Hawaii, gosh, I'd buy 2 books if I was a golfer.
Yeah, for that opportunity.
And I'd be happy to pay the flight to Hawaii for that.
Right.
Especially,
so really,
you know, if you offer them a 2 or 3 day stay and then they get golf each day, I mean, gosh, the incentive is really strong.
Right.
And the cost to you would be pretty low.
Pretty much, yes. It wouldn't be that much, actually,
yeah,
to generate that kind of energy.
And the reason I'm spending some time with you on it is that the other people in the webcast can be thinking the same way. Is there something of value in terms of a prize that you could offer people that only one or two or three people win that would increase the value and the incentive to want to, you know, buy into your Amazon campaign or your New York Times campaign?
Mm.
Okay.
Got it. So thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Sure. Anybody else with questions?
Yes, John?
I told people I would stay online as long as there were questions. And again, you can still submit it through the website if you want to. Nobody has recently, but if you do, I will read it. So if you're listening to this on the webinar and you're not live, and you can't talk to me live, you can always still submit questions through the website. Go ahead.
Hello, John?
Yeah.
This is Michael John. If you have a spiritual book, that's, let's say, Christian in nature, is that the right type that can go on to be a New York Times bestseller?
Was The Prayer of Jabez a bestseller?
Yes, it was.
Was The Purpose-Driven Life a bestseller?
Yes.
So the answer is
yes,
of course. You know, yes, there are many, many Christian books that have become New York Times bestsellers or hit the Publisher's Weekly bestseller list or another bestseller list.
Great.
There's also, of course, the Evangelical Christian bestseller list, which is very much an active list maintained by the Christian bookstores.
Hmm.
And all of those are valuable lists to get on.
Is the approach for the New York Times bestseller with the spiritual book a lot different in your teleseminar?
No, the approach would be very much the same because you're basically using a combination of the Amazon campaign on steroids plus the other strategies that I teach in the seminar. And those strategies apply to any audience. And with you, of course, you have a very big audience. And the really neat thing about any kind of spiritual book is that you tend to have a very strong, committed audience. That once they start talking about it, you can sell a lot of books.
Wow. Does the New York Times criteria for sales of books, when you say an Amazon steroid type of strategy, does that mean that the Amazon part of it is part of the criteria that New York uses?
Amazon sales are taken into consideration on the New York Times list, but they're discounted. So the Amazon strategy is used, but you do not send people to Amazon. You send them to bookstores.
Oh, okay.
There's a whole strategy to doing that and how to do it that I teach in the seminar, because you have to have sales through bookstores to be on the New York Times list. And while New York Times now does count Amazon sales, they discount it, and that means that they don't give it the same value that as sales in bookstores.
How much do they discount it, 50% or more?
If there's a big blip in sales in one day, they probably throw all those sales out.
Wow.
So people doing Amazon bestseller campaigns over one day are probably not being counted at all on the New York Times list.
Mm.
Because they see it as an artifact.
Yes. Now, when you do,
whereas if there's steady sales throughout the week, they might count all the sales or 50% or I don't know. Nobody knows the exact formula they use, but they do what's called a weighted average, and that means that the sales in Iowa City are counted different from sales in New York City are counted different from sales in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually do a weighted campaign. They're If you were to sell, 10,000 books through bookstores in Iowa, you would not hit the New York Times list because they wouldn't count all those sales.
Hmm.
And they would discount them because they weren't sales in New York City, where people are much more discriminating book buyers. At
so
least
New
according
York is
to
a
the,
very important part of the strategy, then.
You do have to have sales throughout the country. You can't be in just one regional area and expect to hit the New York Times list. They will discount it.
Mm.
I know they do that. I don't know exactly how they do it, but I know they do that.
Then is
so you really have to you have to create a strategy that makes sure that your book is available in as wide a distribution as possible, and that your marketing, whatever you're doing, is as widely available as possible, so that the sales can be generated nationwide rather than just regional or local.
And then national campaigns are going to be the best for this New York Times strategy when you teach it. That's going to be a focus,
yes.
A great focus.
Yes, part of it is that you have to have national distribution. The other part is that you have to do a national Amazon campaign and a national whatever other elements you're going to put into the campaign, whether it's publicity speaking or whatever, has to have a national tinge to it.
Oh, yes. Great. Thank you very much, John.
Sure. Any other questions?
Hi, John. This is Darian. I'm Darren's wife calling from Hawaii.
Sure. Yeah, you're the novelist.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, and I'm so sorry to be so dense on this issue about trade fiction paperback, but it was really enlightening, that issue, that point, that it's just so difficult, and you're right. And so I guess where I am is just trying to understand, for those of us who are publishing fiction in the trade paperback format, what would be the best strategy then for us to – where should we put our energy, I guess? You know, where do we make the most of our energy?
You know what I would do?
What?
I would give away as many copies as I could of my ebook to build the audience for my second book.
So what you mean?
And if I can give away enough copies and sell enough copies of the first book, maybe I can convince my New York publisher the next time around to do a hardcover.
I already signed for a second trade paperback.
Okay. Are your books literary fiction, or are they genre fiction, or
no,
what are they?
They're women's fiction, a little bit comedic, a little bit romance, but they focus on the woman, not necessarily, you know, that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, your second book should then be a hardcover. The reason they're not doing hardcover is that you didn't sell enough of the trade paperback yet to justify launching you in hardcover. They're still building the audience for you.
Right.
That's their strategy. I'm giving you their thinking behind what they're doing.
Sure.
And it may mean that you have to, your job essentially is to continue to build fans for your fiction to the point that the publisher is comfortable to do a hardcover version.
So do you have
And
like
that means that I would try to give away copies to people as an ebook.
Okay.
I would try what's that?
Did you say an ebook?
Yes, as an ebook. You don't want to give away physical copies that cost you money, but you can give away an ebook.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
I don't have an ebook.
Will the publisher allow you to give away an ebook?
I don't know. Is the ebook the exact same replica of the entire trade fiction book?
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Usually in PDF format or some other ebook format.
Oh. Okay.
Now, the chances are that in your contract, the New York publisher owns the ebook rights and you can't give them away.
I see. Yeah, probably. Especially with Penguin, yeah, probably.
If you can't give away the entire book, ask them if you can give it away one chapter a week. And then once the first chapter, the next week, you give the second chapter and you take away the first chapter. The
Got
next
it.
Week, you give away the third chapter and you take away the second chapter. So
and
that
for my website to download.
What's that? Yeah, they would download it then from your website. It'll be in a PDF format, so all they have to do is click on the link, and the PDF program will come up, and they'll be able to read it, and also save it to their computer if they want to.
Got it.
Now,
okay.
A publisher might allow you to do that kind of serialization. They probably will not allow you to give away the entire book at once, because they're probably trying to sell the ebook as well.
I don't know.
A discount, too.
Okay. Well, we don't even have the search inside function going for my book, so I'm not so sure.
Okay, so they may not even have the ebook available yet.
Yeah. But also, that's a great question. So basically,
this is the same strategy for anybody who's an unknown author, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is part of what your job is to create word of mouth for your book. And to start to build an audience for your book. 80% of all books are sold by word of mouth. And if you're an unknown author, the toughest thing is to get people to sample your work. And the best way to get them to sample it is to give away at least a part of it if you can't give away the whole of it.
Right. Okay, so what's the number then that you would want to make that you think would justify, say, a publisher going to hardcover? Like how many copies would be a respectable number?
If they're doing trade paperback publishing, they're going to want at least 20 or 30,000 copies sold to justify going to hardcover.
I've sold 20,000, I think.
So then they might start to be interested. It depends on the publisher and their criteria. It may mean that they may require 50 or 100,000, but I'm sure the minimum is 20,000. I'm sure that's the minimum.
Okay.
And they may require a bigger audience than that, especially as a first-time author.
Okay.
But given the kind of book that you're writing, it should be hardcover.
Okay. Okay.
You should be promoted as sort of chick lit or some variation of chick lit.
Right. No, it is. It is. So let me just ask a general question then about, since you're talking about ebooks, and so for those of us who are thinking about doing ebooks. So in terms of how it works, if you offer a free ebook download of your actual book, what's the risk of it taking away sales of the actual hard you know, copy book?
A very, very slim.
Really?
I'll give you a couple examples to show you that. One is that Seth Godin gave away 200,000, 300,000 copies of his Creating the Idea Virus. When he brought out the hardcover version that he published himself, the book hit the New York Times bestseller list right away.
Okay.
It didn't hurt sales. I'll give you another example. This is about 5 or 10 years ago. Rough Guides, they're a publisher of travel books. When they put their travel books online, the entire content of all the travel books online, they doubled retail sales in the next year.
Wow.
It didn't hurt their sales at all.
Okay.
The, generally speaking, the people that are going to read an entire book online are not the people that are going to buy your book. The people that will read a chapter of it and then go out and buy the book are the people that are going to buy your book.
I see. Okay.
So the chances are you're going to increase sales rather than decrease sales if you give away a version of your ebook.
Got it.
The history so far indicates that that is true. There's a whole controversy right now in the science fiction world because the vice president of the Science Fiction Writers of America wrote this blog entry saying, "Hey, fellow authors, don't give away your book. You're cutting into my sales. You know, blah, blah, blah. You're devaluing our books." And every other author wrote in and said, "No, we're increasing the audience for our books. It pays us to give away our books. Blah, 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 blah. You are stupid.
Right.
You won't be vice president next year." You know, whatever. But the controversy was very, very strong, and it was a very heated argument because the one guy was arguing that it was cutting into their sales and delegitimizing them. But everybody else had a history and a track record that showed that when they gave their book away, they increased their sales, they increased the momentum, they increased their ability to get a higher advance the next time around, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate all the great information you gave us today.
Sure. Anybody else?
I have
a question.
Yes. I'm Bella from Santa Barbara. I have a question about the usefulness of blogging. Specifically, I'm an official blogger for the Huffington Post, which has a great audience. So is there any added value to blogging either on Amazon or on my own site when those sites are probably not going to get the viewers that Huffington Post will?
Will the Huffington Post allow you to repost your blog entry on Amazon and your website?
You should ask them that.
And if you can, then I might repost them to my Amazon and to my website. When you first started talking about blogging, before you said you were with the Huffington Post, the first thing I was going to tell you is, I think for most individual authors to create their own blogs is a waste of time, unless you can create the audience, which is very tough to do. And so what I've been recommending a lot of authors do is to join a group blog like the Huffington Post or Blog Critics or somebody like that. Where there's already a built-in audience, and you don't have to post as often. How often do you post?
Right. It just depends on what else is going on, and if I see a good hook to write something about, because I want to
post. You can post once a week and still get visibility, or even less if you want with the Huffington Post.
Right, but I
can
want
I ask
all my...
You, what did it take for you to become an official blogger on the Huffington Post?
I had quoted from one of the posts in my book, and I wrote to that blogger to ask her if I could use her quote in my book, and I sent her the entire last chapter of my book because I liked it, and she sent it to her editor at the Huffington Post, not Ariana, but somebody else, and then that person said, we'd love to, after she read what I had written, she said, we'd love to have you blog for the Huffington Post.
Okay, great.
So it was based on reading my work.
All right. And you know, some strategy like that is what will work for a lot of other authors in terms of trying to open up, you know, to blogging on a group blog, whatever it might be.
Okay.
A lot of those are invitation only or something like that. But
yeah.
if I were writing the kind of entries that the Huffington Post would like,
mm-hmm.
I would certainly be contacting them and, you know, asking to be a blogger on their site if that was my audience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, eventually I might do that for one of the future books that I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I blogged on my website about Al Gore and his energy use increasing in the past 3 years, and I don't know if Huffington Post would like that. But I think that, you know, personally, I think that Gore is as they would say in the old American tongue, two-forked, you know, the tongue, forked tongue, because he's advocating one thing, but in his own personal life, he's increased the energy use. And I think that that's bad form. You know, and that's just a personal opinion. That doesn't mean that what he has to say isn't valid. It's just that if you're going to tell other people to, you know, cut their energy use, et cetera, you should be doing the same thing in your own life. And he wasn't. And to me, that's just bad form. So I don't know if Huffington Post would like me because I blogged about that.
Hmm.
But I think that you should walk your talk. And that's it. You know, I can talk about, you know, I'm basically apolitical in terms of a Democrat, Republican, or whatever, but I do believe you should walk your talk, and I think it's disingenuous of him to tell people and then increase his own energy use.
Mm. If I can
So I don't know if Huffington would like me because of that one blog, but I've done other blogs that they would probably like.
What do you think of trying to do speaking like the Learning Annex or those kinds of places to increase sales?
Almost every best-selling self-help and spiritual author of the past 20 years has become a best-selling author because they spoke.
Okay.
They spoke at Learning Annexes. They spoke at Unity churches or other churches. They spoke at different places where there were venues where they could reach a wide audience and start to create word of mouth. The minute somebody hears you speak, they become a much more passionate advocate for what you have to, what you're writing about and what you're speaking about. And they're much more likely to say, here's a good book. I just heard this guy speak. You got to read his book. Than if they had just read the book. So I think there's a lot of value.
Is there a way to get to Learning Annex without just sending one of those informal forms that they have online?
I would usually call them and try to pitch that way.
Okay.
If they don't have voicemail hell. Otherwise, probably the best way to reach them is to talk to an author that you know is speaking there already and ask them if they have the phone number, direct line phone number for somebody that books them. And if they would share that with you. My experience is that most book authors and publishers are very good people in terms of sharing information and resources.
In fact, I've
built my career on that supposition because most of the ideas I share I've stolen from somebody else.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, they've given it to me, and they knew I was going to pass it on. And my experience is that there are a lot of people that are open to that. So, like, when I go to Book Expo America, the other name for it is John Kramer's Fan Club. And I go there to talk with people and get their new ideas, the new stories, what's working with for them. And almost everybody will share that information with me. And they know I'm going to pass it on because that's what I do.
This woman has no personality.
Go ahead. Next question. Anybody else?
Yeah, John?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. This is Kevin in Greentown. How are you tonight?
Good. I was just going to drink a water.
I have a question for you. There's a discrepancy in numbers. It would be between 2,000 and 10,000 copies of a book to make the list.
Yes. And
what is the easiest of books? Obviously, novel being the one that needs the most amount of copies.
Yes. Hardcover nonfiction requires the least. It's tough
okay.
to be number one on hardcover nonfiction, but it's, you know, the list includes the top 15, so becoming the 15th or 14th can be done.
Right. And so we did an Amazon.com, a bestseller campaign, and it was pretty well organized, and it was nice and easy because everything was categorized. So you're only fighting against people in your own category. Does the New York Times list have that same criteria?
No, not really.
It would just be all hardcover nonfiction books.
There's that category. There's also the what they call the miscellaneous trade paperbacks, advice, self-help, something like that category. And that category is very competitive.
Okay.
They also have a children's list, and they have a fiction list. So they have a number of lists that they do. But you really want to be probably, if you're doing nonfiction, you want to be in the hardcover nonfiction.
Right.
That's the least.
And you want to have you want to run the campaign in January or August.
That's the best time. It doesn't mean that that's the only time. That's the least competitive time.
Looking for optimum results, that's when the numbers are going to decrease from the 10,000 copies in a week to move closer to the 2,000.
Right.
Okay.
And I've actually seen books hit the New York Times bestseller list with 10,000 copies in print, so I know that, you know, how many they sold. I've seen books hit the Publisher's Weekly bestseller list, which is very similar to the New York Times bestseller list, with only as few as 1,000 copies sold in 1 week.
Okay.
So, you know, and there's variation, you know, so there's no way to predict it, so you always try to aim towards the highest number to ensure that you do it if you're going to do that kind of campaign.
Of course. And obviously the New York Times campaign is the campaign to do, because that is, you know, obviously the most prestigious of titles.
Yes, the New York Times list is the list. When you're talking about bestsellers, that's the most recognized list. That's the list that everybody else tracks and tracks over the years. Much more so than the Publishers Weekly list, the Wall Street Journal list, the USA Today list, etc.
It doesn't hurt.
I mean, any bestseller list you get on is great.
Right.
And you can use it as a way of validating. But it's only the New York Times list that gets in the front of the store. It's only the New York Times list that gets discounted. It's only the New York Times list that everybody focuses on when they're really talking about a bestseller.
Right. Because the Wall Street Journal list, I understand, is a little easier to hit for a non-fiction book.
Yes, but it's primarily business titles. And it's a great list to be on for business list, and it can help to open the door to the New York Times list.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
And
I'll tell you, in the
New York Times teleseminar, I tell you more about the insight of how the list is developed, how it's put together, so that you have all the strategies in place in terms of what you need to do to get on that list.
Okay, so is the program kind of like a push-the-button type program? This is what you need to do. There's no magic dust here. You need to do the work. In other words, it's laid out to do. You follow step A, step B, step C, step D, and there's no magic dust and no guarantees, but following this, you have a pretty good chance of hitting the list?
I would say that you look at, read my strategy and so on, the chances of anybody hitting the list doing my program is probably somewhere around 10 or 20%.
Okay.
To be quite honest, because there's just too many variables in terms of how you do things and so on, that if you miss one of them, you're not going to make the list. You know, you think you might have covered it, but you didn't. Something like that. Now, part of what I'm going to do for the people that sign up for the you know, Tuesday's call and are what I call my pioneers, is I'm going to do more hand-holding. So I'm going to do a series of teleseminars where people can simply ask questions. Well, here's what I've done so far, but I'm having trouble here. Do I need to do more in order to ensure I'm going to get on the list, et cetera, et cetera? So I'm going to probably do a weekly teleseminar call with the participants, only them, to help them hold their hands and answer their questions, because I want the pioneers to be successful, because then, you know, once I have more stories to tell, it's even easier to sell the program. But after the pioneer level, I'm going to be charging more for the program.
Okay.
Because it doesn't make sense not to.
Right.
The value of hitting the New York Times list is way more than the $500 I'm charging now.
Okay.
So it's very possible that I will be charging about the same as some of the people running the Amazon campaigns. You know, there's
actually,
some people
they're charging a lot more.
Well, there are people that are teaching you how to do the Amazon campaign, which is a paltry thing compared to this, and charging you $3,000 to $5,000 just to learn how, or charging you $15,000 to run the campaign for you.
Right.
And personally, I would never pay $15,000 to somebody to run the campaign, because I think you should do the campaign yourself.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Now, learning from one of them, I mean, you know, the programs that some people have to offer are certainly valuable. I mean, I know people who have done them and been successful as a result, who might not have been successful if they had just tried to do it on their own. I mean,
we wouldn't have made the list. We did it twice, two different books. I made it both times in the list, but using the principles they taught us. But theirs was, you know, it was really a seriously push the button. This, we had everything set up, and you push the button on the day they told you to push the button, and the next thing you know, the book hit the bestseller, and you just watched it grow. Because it was electronic media, you were able to log on every hour, the book climb all the way up.
And that's why most people settle for the Amazon campaign, because it is a little bit more push button. The disadvantage of it, of course, is that you don't sell nearly the numbers that you can with a New York Times bestseller list if you do it right. And you don't get the prestige, you don't get the bookstore display, you don't get the discounted, you don't get all the things that really go into being a New York Times bestseller.
Right.
But it's easier.
Right.
And there's no question about it. It's 10 to 20 times easier.
Okay.
If the New York Times was as easy, people would be doing it. But the reality is that most people won't have a clue of how to carry it out. I know how to do it because I've done it with several people already. I worked with Bob Allen on his campaign. I worked with Deepak Chopra on his campaign, etc. So I know some of the strategies. I know what goes into creating a New York Times bestseller. And what I'm doing is adapting the Amazon campaign to boosting everything else that you're doing to create that New York Times bestseller.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. This has been very informative.
I'm going to take a drink of water if somebody else wants to ask a question.
How long does the campaign take when we work with you for the New York Times bestseller campaign? How long is the duration of time that you have to do this push?
It would be very similar to the Amazon campaign, but you have to do it on steroids. In other words, for a successful Amazon campaign, you might be able to mail to 300,000 people and be successful. For a New York Times campaign, that number has to triple to be, you know, or be even more.
Yeah.
You have to mail to, so you have to create more relationships. You have to make sure those relationships are solid so that people actually do what they say they're going to do, et cetera, et cetera. So it takes a lot more attention to detail, a lot more focus, a lot more commitment from your partners in the campaign in order to be successful in it. You know, I've heard horror stories of people that do the Amazon campaign, and what happens is the day that it happens, three people's email list isn't working that day, four other people decided not to do it for whatever reason, five other people, you know, suddenly they had no campaign at all. And if you're going to expect to hit the New York Times list, you can't have that kind of looseness. You have to have very confirmed, committed partners in your campaign that kind of thing won't happen.
Is it one big blast surge once you've set it up and you have all these relationships like the other campaign?
It'll be very similar in terms of the Amazon campaign, except that you're doing it over a week period instead of one day.
Oh, great. Okay.
Because the measurement for the New York Times is 1 week, not, you know, 1 hour or 1 day or something like that.
Yes.
Whereas with the Amazon campaign, you know, a lot of people maybe hit number one, but they do it for about 3 minutes during a window, you know. And now you can claim you were number one in Amazon, you know, even if it was only for those 3 minutes. And that's fine. That's a perfectly valid thing to do. I think it's wrong to be call yourself an Amazon bestseller if you were only in the top 100. Personally, I think you have to be in the top 10 of the major list, not a special interest list, to legitimately call yourself an Amazon bestseller. That's my own personal opinion. Now, I know a lot of people have called themselves bestsellers with a lot less. They might be number one for sports books or something like that. And if I were going to promote that, I would say I was the number one Amazon bestseller for sports books. I would not call myself a number one Amazon bestseller. I would be very specific on what the criteria was. But that's me, because that's the way that I live and work. You know, it's your choice in terms of how you do it, but that's the way I define an Amazon bestseller. You're in the top 10 at some point.
Yes.
But I know a lot of people that call themselves Amazon bestsellers that were in the top 100 or even in the top 100 of their special interest, which is like, you know, that's to me, it's a joke. But I understand the motivation for wanting to call yourself a best-selling author, so, you know, I'm not going to condemn people for it, but I don't think it's, to me, that's not right. I think you should be very specific in terms of how you are a bestseller.
John, is there a budget that someone should have ready when they join your program in order to make sure that they follow through and they don't end up the 20%, you know, seeking to be in that 20%, they fail? Is it a lot of times because budgetary as well? What is the budget they should have ready to push their book in the New York Times bestseller?
I think you should have a budget.
Money, I'm sure.
The ideal budget is $10,000. You could do it for less. But if you can have $10,000, and the reason you have the $10,000 is primarily distribution issues. It has nothing to do with running the Amazon steroid campaign. It has more to do with ensuring that you have the distribution. And there's very specific ways you spend that money to ensure that you're supporting and ensuring that you get the widest distribution.
Okay, great.
And in the campaign, in the seminar and in the materials, I tell you how to spend that money, where it's going to be most effective, and how it will help to support your distribution.
Okay, great.
And whether or not you need to spend that much, you need to spend more the worse your distribution is.
Mm-hmm.
The better your distribution is, the less money you have to spend. Because the money that you're going to spend in the New York Times program, it's basically going to be to ensure you get the widest possible distribution, which is essential to creating a New York Times bestseller.
Do you in the program offer distribution outlets that would be best for our books type?
I walk you through that. I will answer questions on that. If you don't have good distribution now, I will help you try to find the best distribution for your book.
Okay, great.
Because that is essential. The reality is that if you're doing print-on-demand, though, or somebody said they were doing Trafford Publishing, which is basically, I think, print-on-demand, your chances of being a New York Times bestseller are essentially silch, not no way. And that's because of the number of books you have to have in the stream. The only other place that you're going to spend money on this program is you're going to have to print enough copies to have in the distribution stream to make it happen.
Yes.
And so, you know, besides what money you might spend on advertising and distribution support, you would also have to spend some money on printing books if you don't already have them in print.
What would be the limited amount that you could start from to get on the New York Times bestseller of a first printing?
Well, ideally, you want to have 2,000 to 3,000 copies in the distribution mix. That means they're somewhere where people can get them quickly. That means they're either at the warehouse for your distributor or publisher, they're at Ingram, or they're actually physically in the stores. Ideally, they're physically in the stores.
Mm.
And again, I'll tell you the strategies to use to get them into the stores and not just on the where you know the wholesale shelf and so on.
Mm-hmm. Great. When we do all these things, John, when we do all these things right, let's say when we get every part, we have the budget, we do it right, does that percentage go up from that 20%, or is that when you're doing everything right, 80% are going to fail?
Boy, that's a... I would say that you increase the percentage maybe by 10.
Okay.
Well, let me give you an example. New York publishers... 3 out of 4 books they try to get on the bestseller list, and these are the ones that are trying to get on the bestseller list. They're spending $100,000 to $200,000 on these. They're printing 100,000 copies. They're flooding the stores with the books. They're successful 1 out of 4 times.
Hmm.
So their success rate is 25%. Now, with what I'm going to teach you, I'm hopefully going to increase that percentage, but I don't... Right now... I'm comfortable saying somewhere around 30% if you do everything right. I don't know for sure yet until I, you know, actually take some pioneers through the whole program, see what they do, and then I can start to actually quote real numbers based on those people that actually did, you know, did what I told them to do and then how successful they were. But I know it's a challenge. I mean, there's so many... little pieces that have to be in place to make it work. I know what New York publishers spend to try to make it happen and how often they fail. So I know that there's, you know, I don't want to oversell the program in the sense of guaranteeing something. When I start charging $5,000 or $10,000 for the program, I'm probably going to offer a stronger guarantee, but then I'll know exactly what percentage I can quote because the pioneers will have done what they've done and I'll know what I can guarantee.
John, in the past, like the Seacock and others that you have taken or helped take to New York
Times bestseller? I've been 100% successful with those people that I've worked with individually.
Yes, and do you believe, are those same campaign strategies inside of your new telemarketing or your teleseminar?
Yes, yes. I'm using the same strategies, but I'm adding the Amazon component plus other strategies that I've learned since that time.
Okay, great.
John, how much lead time do you need to get this going if you don't have a list and you don't have the relationships yet? How much lead time do you think you would need to be able to do this?
Me? I'd need about 2 weeks. Most other people most other people probably need 3 to 6 months, depending on how long it takes to create the relationships that you need to create. You know, personally, right now, I feel I can create a relationship with anybody on the web. And depending on how comfortable you are in creating those relationships, it will take you anywhere from 2 weeks on up to 6 months. It should take you more than 6 months. Typically, it should take about 12 weeks. That's to get everything in place, to contact enough people. Because to do a New York Times bestseller campaign, you're going to have to be exposing probably as many as 2 to 3 million people to your message. The typical Amazon campaign goes to 300,000 to 500,000 people. That's to give you a difference in terms of of why I say it has to go on steroids. It can't be the typical Amazon campaign.
And I haven't looked at the list lately, but do they have books for entrepreneurs on that list?
The New York
Times.
Like
a how-to book for entrepreneurs? Is that the kind of thing that might end up on that list?
Yes, it could. Certainly, Jeff Gittimer's sales books have been on it. Some of Seth Godin's books have hit the New York Times bestseller list, and they're very much aimed at entrepreneurs. So, again, it depends on the book. You know, you need a general enough audience that, 2 to 10,000 people will respond. That's why, I don't think that for 1,001 Ways to Market Your Books, I could do a New York Times bestseller campaign. It's just not general interest enough. My book gets shelved in light reference. And, how many people go to light reference versus how many people go to the business section? I can tell you the difference in traffic is at least probably 100 times. And, that makes a difference. That's nothing bad. I'm happy with my book. I'm happy with the sales that I get from the book, and I'm doing very well with it. But doing a New York Times campaign for that book would not be, to me, practical. I'd rather spend my time doing other things, for that book. But if I had a general interest business book, I would do the New York Times campaign. And I do have one I'm going to write someday when I get around to it.
Do you have to do it soon after your pub date, or can you sort of release it and then try to do it like a year later?
You can do it any time in the life cycle of the book, just as you can do an Amazon campaign at any time. The biggest difficulty with the New York Times campaign will be, do you still have distribution? Because that distribution has to be in place. Just absolutely no question about that. The distribution has to be there because otherwise New York Times can't count the sales because the sales has to be through bookstores. So if you still have effective, adequate distribution or can help to support that distribution by, buying into certain programs and so on, then you do have a possibility even 3 or 4 years later to create a New York Times bestseller. There have been self-published books that hit the New York Times list 3 years after they were published. The classic example of that is When I Grow Old, I Shall Wear Purple. And that was a collection of short stories and poems by unknown women. And that hit the New York Times bestseller list, but it was only, I think, 2 years after the publication date for the book.
John,
Anyhow, so yes, it's possible to do it afterwards, but the distribution has to be in place. And again, I would work with you in terms of getting that in place.
Your weekly seminars are for this program, right?
The weekly ones that I will do, the follow-up ones will be for the seminar, for the pioneers, the people that are participating in the program.
Over what period will you do that?
I will probably do it for the next 10 to 12 weeks. Okay. I'll do it as long as there's a demand for it, for the people that are in the initial program. Once my Tuesday seminar is done, I will not be doing the teleseminar series again until I've taken the pioneers through the program. I might make the program available to people that just want to buy it, but they'll have to listen to the recordings that I've done. And then they can still join in later, but then they'll be they won't be able to ask as many questions because they won't be involved in the beginning. But that's fine, it still could be valuable for some people that choose to do it that way.
You talk about an April 10th recording. What happened on April 10th?
That was the first recording I did for this Taoist seminar where I told people I described the entire program, what you needed to do. And I provided them with a lot of different support material, which I'm still working on, some of the support material. The May 8th is going to be essentially a duplicate of that call plus additional questions because some of the people that were in the April 10th call will join us in the May 8th call, and they'll have additional questions because they will have been already trying to work on the program.
Do you know what day your weekly calls will be for the group?
No, I'm going to ask on Tuesday when they would like it.
Okay. Great, thank
but
you.
But I'm thinking about doing some of the calls during the day and some maybe at night, and then I might do it at different times so that different people, depending on, you know, and all the calls will be recorded, so again, you can listen to them.
Right.
And you can also, you know, through the same technique you did here, submit questions ahead of time.
Great, thank you.
For those of you who weren't on the Tao Seminar right away, the program that I'm using is called InstantTaoSeminar.com. It's a new program. It was just made available, I think, on Tuesday, and I signed up for it. It's like $47 a month, and you can do unlimited Tao Seminars. By phone, you can have up to 200 guests, and by on the webinar, you can have up to 2,000 guests at one time. And every call is recorded. And it costs $47 a month to do it. So, you know, now it's easy for me to offer a weekly teleseminar and webinar to my pioneers in this best-selling campaign because it doesn't cost me any more money. It just costs me my time. And right now I'm committed to taking that time with these pioneers because I want to have some good stories to tell. I want these people to be successful. So in the April 10th call, I started calling them my pioneers because they were the first people to, you know, to do this program with me. And it is sort of like being a pioneer because, you know, I don't have all the stories to tell you yet. I don't have all the success stories. I don't have all the little inside secrets of what somebody did that was a little bit different than what thought would work, and it worked for them. Once I have all those stories, it's going to be even that more valuable. So I'm willing to sell it at a lower price to the pioneers and work with them harder because they're taking a chance with me.
Is the April group a different group, or will you be taking us through together?
Well, I'll be taking the April and the May group together. I'm considering them one group. They're the pioneers. Okay. And the people who sign up for the May 8th will have access to the recording from the April 10th call. And will then have access to the entire program. They're pioneers, just like the April 10th group.
All right, thank you.
Hey John,
yeah.
Does it make a difference if you're self-published or you have a publisher? You just need distribution, and
you just need
how
distribution.
To do that, whether we're either.
It doesn't matter if you're self-published or published by a larger publisher. It's just a matter of how you arrange your distribution to make sure you have good enough distribution.
So New York Times. Does not look
you know, there have been, let me just finish, over the last 20 to 30 years, there have been probably something like 50 books that have hit the New York Times bestseller list that were self-published. And, you know, a lot of them, I know their stories, I know what they did, you know, so on and so forth. Some of them became bestsellers after they sold the rights to a New York Times publisher. For example, like The Celestine Prophecy. It did not hit the New York Times bestseller list until a New York publisher published, you know, republished it. In fact, it's probably more like 100 then when you count all the people that were republished by a New York publisher. So it's actually a very good number. I mean, it's not impossible to be a self-publisher and hit the New York Times list. And in fact, in some of the supporting material that I give to you with this program, you will get stories of how other people created bestsellers using other techniques than what I'm teaching in this particular program. Because I want you to have those stories too, because hopefully you'll supplement the Amazon strategy with a lot of other things to help make it even more possible that you'll hit the list.
So, John, if I were to sign up for this Tuesday seminar,
yeah.
And I have a publisher, that's St. Martin's, should I ask them certain questions in advance to be sure they're on board?
How long have they been publishing your book? Or have they published
it yet? Since mid-November. Yes, it came out in mid-November.
So, yes, you would probably want to ask them what kind of commitment they still have to the book and whether or not how many books are still in the pipeline.
I think there are about 6,000 in the stores right now.
Okay, but you want to make sure that they're still going to be there 2 or 3 months later when you actually push the button to do your program. So you'll want to know that they're still committed to keeping the books and the stories that long.
Okay, but that's not really their decision, isn't it, the booksellers themselves?
Yes, but the publisher has an impact on that by their returns policy, whether or not, you know, they abandon the book and the booksellers realize that the publishers abandon the book, and then they start returning them. There's a lot of signals that publishers send booksellers that tell them whether or not to abandon the book or not. And St. Martin's could be sending those signals unintentionally. So you want to know that they still have a commitment to your book.
Okay.
So they're not sending the wrong signals. The second thing that you might ask them is whether or not they're doing any merchandising programs for your book now, or if they would be open to doing any merchandising programs for you. In the teleseminar, I'll describe that and the possibilities in much more detail. But they'll understand that question if you ask it to them.
Yeah, they've been negative on ads. They say they don't think ads are cost-effective.
No, and most times they're not. But there are certain places where you can advertise that would be cost-effective. And there are certain places where you would do merchandising programs, which are not ads, that would
mm-hmm.
also be cost-effective.
Okay.
Now, whether or not they would do it or you would have to put the money for it is certainly a question that has to be negotiated between you and them. And chances are you'd probably have to foot the bill.
And I have a paperback coming out in November. Is that relevant?
Yes, it may be that that's the book you focus on for the New York Times.
The paperback?
The paperback, yeah, the next one coming out. Now,
so
tell me, what's the book that came what came out last November? Was that a hardcover?
Yes.
And it was a book about what?
It's called Singled Out, How Singles Are Stereotyped, Stigmatized, and Ignored, and Still Live Happily Ever After.
Okay, and what's the new book about?
The paperback is the paperback version of the book.
Oh, of the same book?
Yes.
Okay. So then you do have to worry about a little bit about their support, because at some point they're going to abandon the hardcover altogether and remainder it, if they're bringing out a trade paperback edition.
But
now, they won't do that at least until probably August. But
right. I mean, they still have 6,000 copies.
Yes, I know. But at some point, they're going to abandon them, and they're going to tell the booksellers to return them, because they're going to be launching the trade paperback. Trust me, they will do that. I don't know when they're going to do it, but you need to ask them about that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Hello? Okay, well.
I'm losing.
Are you there again?
I can. Yeah, your voice is very low. I can't. I'm having trouble hearing you. But
okay, but just understand that they will do that. You know, they let me see there. I've got to do something right now to manage my webcast to make sure this keeps recording if we're going to go on. I think I may have to. Okay, there it is. I got it quick to extend 15 minutes. because we were running out, we had 20 seconds left on the call. Is there anybody else with questions?
Yeah, John, does it only take one person to do this once they've gone through your campaign, or do you need to delegate responsibilities to others?
It can be done both ways. One person can do it. But if you've got, other responsibilities, you may need to have somebody else working with you. And it certainly doesn't hurt to have a team, whatever that might be for you, whether it's just your spouse or it's somebody you're hiring or something like that. Because there is a, you know, a certain number of things that you really do and have to get into place. If you don't feel you can do it on your own, then you've got to have a partner, somebody you hire, whatever it might be, helping you out. Especially probably the most crucial time thing might be creating the relationships to make sure you're mailing out to 2 to 3 million people and exposing them to the campaign and building that rapport and making sure that that's going to happen is probably the most time-consuming element of the entire campaign.
You say 2 to 3 million people. Do you mean mostly through email relationships and partnerships?
The exposure to the 2 to 3 million people is the same with Amazon. It's easing exposure, website exposure, and blog exposure.
Okay.
Depending on how those people reach their audience. Somebody asked a question, do I do any private consultations? Yes, I do. I charge $500 an hour for that. And people are very willing to pay that much because it's usually worth it. But, you know, so actually, you know, if you're thinking of doing a private consultation with me for $500 an hour, you might want to just buy into this program at $497 and just ask your questions during the teleseminars. But if you've got personal questions that you don't want to share with other people, you don't want the answers shared, whatever, or you really have a whole series of questions, then a private consultation is definitely the way to go. No question about that, and I do quite a few of those. But I am expensive, but I am worth it also. There's another question that somebody just emailed to me. Is it worth it for an author to use a subsidy publisher to send a press release to the New York Times? Probably not. But if it's only costing you 39 cents to do it, sure, go ahead. what's it cost you to send a press release? The chances of New York Times covering you if you're using a print-on-demand publisher or something like that is pretty small. But if you're sending information to them with the idea that you're going to be an expert in a story or something like that, it may well be worth it to do that. It still, at any time, could be valuable to people for the New York Times, because they may very well say, yes, hey, that's a good idea. I should do a story about you because you have something interesting to say. And I think at any time, no matter whether you're self-published, print-on-demand, or so on, you should still act as if you've got a real book and a legitimate book, and regardless of how other people judge it, you should from your side be saying, this book is worth it, I am worth it, they should be paying attention to the message I have to tell, and I will do the publicity, and if they tell me, you know, I chose the wrong way to publish, well, eventually I'll get around to, you know, publishing the book on my own or selling the rights to somebody else. And then they'll be ready for the story. I guess that's one way to say it. Any other questions?
John, is there anywhere where it's listed on the Internet how many books are released per month, like January as opposed to April or that kind of thing?
I do not know of any list like that, and I would be surprised if there were one. I'm not even sure if there's anybody that could compile that. The people that could be closest to compiling that would be R.R. Bowker, because of books in print. Did they sell that? It might be information publishing now. But the people at books in print are the only ones that might know what those numbers are. I've never seen them share that information, and the information would always be inaccurate because the publisher might list the publication date of January but not get the book out until March, but they would never update that information.
So how is it that we know that there's a lot less 1 month than another?
Because I know what the New York publishers do.
Mm-hmm.
And they wait until September. And Publishers Weekly has reported that there's much less activity in those months. So that's how I know that there is. And I know the publishing cycles of most of the publishers and when they're going to choose to do release their books. So I know that those 2 months are probably the least active months of the year. January and August.
Oh.
And I'm 98% sure that those are the two lowest numbers,
okay.
with August being the lowest.
Okay, and so if somebody's not necessarily interested in New York Times bestseller list, I think your course sounds like it would be good anyway, just to sell more books, wouldn't it?
Well, there are a number of people that have signed up and said, you know, I've got a print-on-demand book. I'm not going to change how I do that. But your information is so good, I'm joining the program anyway. So, yes, you know, you have to judge by how this free teleseminar was. The information I'm going to give during the teleseminar and follow-up of the paid thing is always much more detailed than what I've given you here. You know, and the thing is that in the follow-up teleseminars, it's basically going to be question and answer, so it's whatever you're concerned about is what I'm going to talk about and answer.
Great. Thank you.
So any other questions? I think I'm going to close it off in 8 minutes because that's when the time is counting down now. But I will be happy to answer questions. There are still, according to my data here, 9 people on the phone call. Some people have dropped
out. Is there any way to get access to BookScan without paying a lot?
Not that I'm aware of. My distributor gives its publishers access to BookScan through the distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And my distributor is National Book Network. I would guess that's true for some other people who are being distributed by a publisher or being published
mm-hmm.
by a publisher, that they will have
mm-hmm.
that access. But
mm-hmm.
if you're self-publishing or something like that, you would have to buy into it, and it's an expensive program.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how important it is to know that information. I haven't actually checked it yet because it's
mm-hmm.
not that important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there are publishers who track that information because they want to know how other books are doing, competing books and so on,
mm-hmm.
as well as how their books are doing in comparison. And for that, it's certainly worthwhile. It's certainly valuable information.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were doing a much more active publishing program myself, or if my consulting clients were asking more questions directed to that, I'd probably be doing more with BookScan. But right now, I don't.
Okay, thanks.
And I think for most individual authors, it certainly wouldn't be worth the money to spend on that when they could be spending it on actually promoting their book.
Mm-hmm.
You can always ask a friend who's a publisher that has access to it to do a search for you.
Okay.
And if they liked you, they would do it.
Okay.
Anybody else with a question?
Can you talk about getting a company or corporation to use your book as a way of promoting their own products?
That's a very wide-ranging question. It would take several hours to answer it. Do you have a specific
okay.
question? You know, I mean, I devote something like 30 or 40 pages to it in my book, so, you know, it's not a brief question. For example,
okay.
A publisher could use your book as a premium. They could use it as a corporate gift. They could use it as a sales incentive. They could use it as a dealer incentive. They could use it as a giveaway. They could use it in their human relations program. So there's a lot of different ways that a book could be used by a corporation.
And is that something you deal with as part of your New York Times program?
No, I don't. If somebody were to ask it the question in the follow-up, I'd probably answer some. But again, it's not because the New York Times doesn't count those sales.
Mm-hmm.
I probably wouldn't spend a lot of time on answering that question in this particular program.
Okay.
You know, for your thing, the key thing is to identify who in the organization, in the corporation, would be interested in using your book and how they would use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would call them or try to arrange some way to meet with them. Ideally, you'd
mm-hmm.
want to meet with them in person. So if you can't arrange to meet them in person in their city, you try to arrange to meet them when they come to your city or at some trade show or something like that where you can sit down with them for a few minutes and pitch your book and how you think your book would be used in their program.
Okay.
To effectively sell into corporations, you have to know what they're doing already. You know, you have to have some idea of how they might use your book in what they're doing already. So one way that you might know is that, let's say that they're already doing a promotion where they're giving, let's say there's a bank that's giving away books to people when they open a new savings account, something like that. And you know that they're doing that, and they're doing it throughout all the branches in the bank. Well, now you might be able to go to them and say, who's the person that made that decision to give away that book? And would you be interested? And then try to reach that person and pitch your book to be used the same way for the next 6 months or the next year, because eventually that book is going to stop being used. And they'll be looking for something else to revitalize the campaign. And if you can show how your book would be even a better book to give away within what they're doing already, then they're going to be more interested in what you have to offer.
Okay. Thanks.
John?
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, I'm on your shopping cart page, and it asks us for a priority code, and I'm wondering if the last 9 people on the call would get a priority code.
No, because I would have to create one. And I don't know. I don't know how to create the priority code yet, so I don't know how to do that. I have to ask them how to do that part yet of that. So right now there isn't a priority code. Sorry. Any other questions? Someday that priority code will be used to offer some sort of discount or something like that, and that's how the priority code, from what, my understanding, that's how it's used. In other words, I could say in a phone call like this, say, hey, the last 9 people here on the website, if you go into here and enter this priority code, you'll get a 10% discount.
That's what I was hoping.
Yeah, I know. I thought that's what your question was, but
yeah.
Right now I haven't implemented it, and I don't know how to. And right now, because of the nature of the program, I do want to keep it at the price it is, because it's to me it's heavily discounted already from what
it
will be when I roll it out in a more formal way.
Yeah, no, your advice is very valuable.
But I always encourage people to ask those kinds of questions, because you never know. And if you don't ask, you don't get an answer. So it's well worth asking.
Yeah.
So we have 2 minutes. If anybody else has a question yet,
John, I have one. Thank you, John.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I understand the New York Times list advertised that they scan 2,500 bookstores as well as Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Do you have to have placement in all 2,500 stores to make the program work, or do you just need the availability? In other words, somebody can walk in the store and order the book because the book is at Baker & Taylor or Ingram, and that's their distributor. Or do you have to have this on the shelf in these stores that they are scanning?
You need to have it on the shelf in enough stores to make a difference. You don't need it in all the stores. You do need it available. As long as people can get it from Ingram, that will make a difference. But you also do need it on the shelves of enough stores to really make it count. Because how many people are going to special order a book?
If you need,
if you need 2,000 people to special order a book, the chances of that happening is pretty slim, and those 2,000 people being counted by the New York Times. So, you know, you need to have a certain number on the shelf.
Okay. So it's not just having the distribution in place, because you can easily get it to Baker & Taylor, Ingram, or wherever. You actually have it on the stores that the New York Times tracks, has to have this book on the shelf the week previous to this.
At least on enough shelves that it can make a difference. And that's one reason in the program I give you my list of the top 700 independent bookstores. But you also want it placed in enough stores to